Well, I'm not calling myself Ali. Ali is my middle name, not my Muslim name, so I'm Sean Christopher Ali Stone.
I think somebody's gonna do something about this. Metrorail, maybe you could take half of Tehran and put it 50 miles south. You could cut the city in half and move it. Because there's too many people here, I think. It's too crowded, it's overcrowded. Iranian people are like to each other because, you know, people behave differently with each other than they do with a foreigner. But as a guest, I feel very welcomed and people are very warm to me. There's definitely a tradition of greeting your guests, of being hospitable. And there's a great, tremendous amount of culture and literacy, intelligence. For the most part, people are they're aware of the world that they live in. They're not ignorant.
Why so many names? Tell me about that.
Well, Sean is my secular first name. Christopher is my Christian name. Ali is my Muslim name. And Stone is my Jewish lineage last name.
Okay, so it's a combination of all.
It is a combination of all. And I'm a combination of all three religions. And that's why I've accepted Islam as a continuation of Judeo-Christianity, that which is my religious base.
You know, I know there's opposition to the government. I don't know the percentages in terms of who's in favor of the president, you know, who's opposed. I think that there's at least a dialogue, and that's the most important thing for a republic. If a republic is going to stand, there has to be an educated citizenry, and there have to be those in favor and those opposed, because you have to have a dialogue. Otherwise, it becomes dictatorship.
Sean, let's talk about it. What made you make this decision? Did you feel that this was just a continuation of, as you said, the Judeo-Christian background? What made you to decide to actually become a Muslim?
I guess I wanted to take the burden upon myself from multiple points of view. In the West, Islam is pilloried now. I mean, I really, just having accepted Islam, you know, I've been ridiculed in the West. People who don't even know me, making allegations about who I am. They've never met me. They don't know the first thing about what I think. And they already, you know, allege that I'm joining a religion of violence, that I must be a spoiled, lost kid. I mean, it's like the insanity of it is, it goes to show the fear that Islam instills in Westerners.
Why? So, why do you think that's the case?
The clash of civilizations. That was a policy that was bred in Washington, 77, 78, 79, I'm sorry, out of England and Washington, the British Empire, British Imperial Doctrine, which is create dissension between the peoples of the world. Always rule by conflict, by creating conflict, synthetically. So what you do is you say we're going to create an arc of crisis. That was the policy from 78, 79 forward in the underbelly of Soviet Union. We're going to basically radicalize Islam, and promote this a more radicalized version of Islam. Although that itself has many connotations, because you know Islam itself is like the Constitution of the United States. It's based on laws which are constantly being reinterpreted. And it has to do with customs and nation states. So I'm someone who believes in nations. The imperial policy doesn't want nations. It doesn't want Iran to be a separate sovereign nation, Saudi Arabia to be separate and sovereign, Egypt to be separate and sovereign. It wants them all to be viewed as Islamic, under the same, some kind of, you know, Soviet type of dictatorship, which it's not. There is no hierarchy of mullahs who are ruling Islam and commanding, you know, fanatics to go and blow themselves up and kill Americans. This is a fantasy. This is something that has been propagated in the West. So because of that clash of civilizations policy, which was written about in the 90s, it was generated in the 90s, Brzezinski talked about it, Sam Huntington, his student at Harvard, talked about it. I studied these guys to a large extent. It was trying to basically breed the tension necessary to now turn America into a vehicle of the British Empire and seize this part of the world, essentially playing upon the conflicts, using that tension to profit with military endeavors, with wars, with resource grabs, by trying to basically get a hold of whatever resources they can in the region. And essentially, it's very difficult to figure out, because it's such a destructive ideology, but Brzezinski talks about in his book, The Grand Chessboard. I mean, this is the richest underbelly of the world. This is Eurasia. This is the heart of Eurasia, right here. Iran, Afghanistan, Iraq, these countries in the Middle East. This is the underbelly of Russia and China. And so if you wanted, for example, a policy of development, of nation states doing what like FDR would have said, have a new deal and develop your country's infrastructure, your economies, and then trade with each other. How do you destabilize Russia, China, India, and Iran from trading with each other? By promoting radical Islam, by promoting the idea that they're fanatics, that there's crazy people, that you can't reason with these people, you can't talk to them. They're just diehard, you know, Islamists, and they want to kill you. And so that's what they're trying to promote in all these countries. Then they're arming the Mujahideen. I mean, the American CIA worked with Al-Qaeda. I mean, that's the irony. They worked with Al-Qaeda in Bosnia. Obviously, they formed the Mujahideen with the Pakistanis and the Saudis in the 80s. And then they go on to use these guys, deploy them wherever they want in the world. So if you wanted to stabilize Bosnia, which is a Christian country, you bring in Mujahideen fanatics, let's say from the Afghan war, and you put them against the Christian Serbs there. Or in Kosovo, you pit them against the Serbs, using the Muslims there. Or in Libya, for example, you use the more radical fanatics of Al-Qaeda operatives against Gaddafi. You know, so every country, they're actually, you know, they're able to deploy these guys in a sense at will. Even now in Syria, look what they're doing. Syria is a secular state. And yet what we're supporting the more radical factions because they're the revolutionaries that are supposed to be taking back their country. And yet there's so many, you know, what are called Salafi or Wahhabi Muslims coming from Saudi Arabia, financed by the Saudis, who are the Taliban. They are the ones who are fanatics, who are stoning women, who frankly have a very different interpretation of the Quran and of Sharia law. Right. So the point is that Islam is not this monolithic empire. People don't understand that. When I take the vow of Islam, I say, I believe that Muhammad was a prophet. The Quran is a beautiful book. Ali was a messenger with in the tradition, same tradition as Muhammad. And Ali's writings are the basis of Islam. Now, if you want to go and talk about interpretation of law, I think every country is going to have a different interpretation, every custom, every people. That is their national right. And I don't want to get into it politically because that's not the basis. To me, it's like, if I'm saying I'm Christian, it's because I love Christ's teachings, not because I'm for the Catholic Church. Mm-hmm. But I can still talk to the Catholics. I can still go and discuss with them. I can come to this country and say, you know, as a Muslim, I understand your point of view, your history, and now I want to talk with you and actually have dialogue. So if I can be that person, if I can be the person who bridges the gap between Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, and being able to say, you are equally my brothers. I'm not more of one religion than the other because there is only one God. So how can you say you're more Muslim than Jewish? Mm-hmm. You see, without Judaism, without Christianity, there is no Islam.
Right, continuation of the same path.
Same path, same principles. But, you know, men will always find ways of, you know, of twisting the words of God towards their end. But how can you blame God for that? You know, if you have faith, if you truly have faith in your heart, you know, what do you have to fear upon the earth? What do you have to fear from another religion? Why is it that you're not able to have a dialogue with someone, have a conversation with them, try to see their point of view? And then, you know, ultimately, I believe nations are based upon this principle, that you don't go around bullying or invading or forcing your will upon another nation state. The same way you don't force your will upon another human being. There's a sense of sovereignty. So I'm in the humanist tradition. I believe in nationalism. I believe that our nation, America, my nation, is becoming corrupted by this imperial seed, which was planted by the British over a century ago. And I studied this, and I've watched it in terms of the mentality. You cannot have this doctrine, this attitude that we have the right to invade other nations unless you're an imperialist. That's an imperialist mentality.
Stop you right there. You just brought up a couple of points as far as the right to invade nations. And, you know, it's coming from imperialist policies. But let's look at far as the United States itself and what we have been seeing, especially over the last decade and going into many different countries, being involved in many different countries, either overtly or covertly. And Let's talk about the Americans themselves. I think a lot of people are, especially in this part of the world, are curious about the American people and why they seem to support these policies.
The American people support them?
Well, this is what it appears to a lot of people in this part of the world.
Yes. You know, ignorance is the root of all evil. I truly believe that. And there's an idiom in the West that says ignorance is bliss. That's satanic, as far as I'm concerned. Anyone who recognizes the consequence of their actions, it becomes responsible for their actions. So to maintain ignorance is to basically deny responsibility for your actions. What happened is that America started to, it's a history in itself, but Americans stopped thinking of their government as their government and started seeing it as the government. And all of a sudden, it was an idea that basically, you know, the government is either, it's too big in social sectors, for example, but the military is good because we have to be defended against what? Against communism. That was really the fear that was instilled into the baby boomer generation. The boomers are still in power in our country. And their children grew up with this fear of the ever-present empire of communism, that they're like the Muslims now, you know, they're hidden in plain sight, they're going to, you know, they want to kill you, they want to destroy your way of life, you know, and it, by planting that paranoia and fear in people, you get a country full of sheep. You don't, you know, where are the leaders, where are the people that are going to stand up and say, enough fear, enough of this nonsense, there's nothing to be afraid of. The only enemy, I mean, the only thing to fear is fear itself. Mm-hmm. Roosevelt was such a leader. He could have handled it. But then you get these kids who grew up in that condition, and all of a sudden, they profited from it, frankly. I mean, they profited from neoliberal policies. They profited all the way through the collapse of the Soviet Union, looting that country. And then just seeing the whole, they were basically given this imperial model, and they had no choice but to follow it, you see. I don't think it's necessarily so much that they were evil as much as they accepted an evil system, because they didn't know how to change it at that point. Once you had imperial politics of the Cold War, because that's what it was. It was basically American imperialism going out saying, we're going to stop the Soviets. But meanwhile, you're bringing neoliberal policies and IMF policies into all the nations of the world, pretty much, you know, based upon fear. And then once you have that system in place, after the Cold War in the 90s, there was a certain discussion that was taking place. There was still discussion, how do we stop this imperial trajectory? Once 9/11 happened, that ended the dialogue. You couldn't have sensible dialogue anymore in our country. Literally, like, dialogue shut down. All of a sudden, if you wanted to have a discussion about the empire, oh, you must be working with the terrorists, you must be working with the Muslims, you want to see them wiping us out across the world. We have to be there, we have to keep our military there, because now it's the terrorists.
So 9/11 was the turning point, you think?
It was the turning point in so many ways. It was, I mean, for me, it was tragic to see what happened. It was the turning point in so many ways. It was, I mean, for me, it was tragic to see what happened to our culture. Because there was a potential to have, like I said, there was a potential for a dialogue now that there was no evil empire to point to and justify our imperialism. There was no, you know, vast external enemy. Once 9/11 happened, this hysteria and paranoia set in so deeply. And then, you know, to go to war with Iraq after Afghanistan. I mean, Afghanistan was one thing, you know, but going to war with Iraq, which was just destroying a sovereign nation state without any pretext, and based on lies, what we know are lies, you know. I did a little documentary for W, my dad's movie, which I worked on with him, on George Bush. I did a 20-minute behind the scenes, just talking to constitutional scholars and people inside the Washington about how these guys had literally lied to the American people and gotten away with it. They had presented them with what were known forgeries. They had, you know, completely overblown estimates. It was such a premeditated deception. And the American people went along with it? Well, some people say the American people actually were on the verge of rebellion at the time, let's say when Bush left office, which was 2008. But why? Because the economy was coming down. Only when the economy came down did people actually existentially realize we're in a crisis.
So it has to affect them personally.
It has to affect them personally. That's the big problem. It's just, you don't want to, you know, you're willing to stay ignorant so long as you have to work, you know, many hours. Frankly, American people work very hard. I mean, the big problem in America is that we're all debt slaves. We're all working just to keep a house over our heads, to feed our kids. I mean, I don't have kids, but essentially to feed ourselves, to pay off our insurance and our loans, and I mean, frankly, our debts are incredible. I don't think most people will ever be able to pay off their debts in their lifetime in America. So you have to understand that when we're not educated, it's partly because we're exhausted, and then the media is the most brainwashed, controlled media you've seen in human history. I mean, frankly, you cannot turn on TV and tell me that there's actual dialogue going on. I mean, at least here, you see people having a discussion. They'll talk for an hour or two. They'll actually have a debate. In America, it's 10-second sound bites. It's slogans. It's, you know, it's propaganda for the most part. There are good people. I mean, there are some good people in the press. But for the most part, it's meant to disorient you and keep you from seeing what's going on. If you don't have a historical understanding of this context, you're lost. You know, thankfully I studied history, but if you don't study history, you don't have no idea what you're doing here. You're just born into this madhouse, you know, wars all over the world. You're a debt slave, you're trying to make money, you're just trying to survive, you want to succeed in life, and you can't even think, you don't have time to even reflect upon what are you doing here as a human soul, as a human being.
And since you've become Muslim, or in that process to becoming Muslim, tell me about your reflection as far as just what you've just said. What are we doing here in this world? What is the goal? What is your purpose?
I accepted this 2 years ago. My purpose is to be a servant of God, to be an instrument of God. I believe that each of us, if we accept that, we are here to serve that which is higher in ourselves and others. You see, the principle of economics in America, the National School of Economics, is predicated on an idea called the harmony of interests. There is no, the worker is also the consumer. You want people to have a good living and have good wages because then they can consume more goods. You want people to have a good standard, a healthy standard of living, to be able to be comfortable, so they have time to create, to dream, to imagine. I think that as humans, you know, we're so caught up with being stuck on a rock that we become like ants. Whereas the moral spiritual imperative is to build things and to create for the greater glory of God, which is the creator of all things. God itself is a creative principle. It's goodness. Why is the word God and good? Why are they so similar? And why is devil and evil so similar? Because there's a principle of goodness which is creative, and there's a principle of evil which is destructive.
The thing is, we came here, well, Scott and myself, as Americans. You take a big risk for reputation, for our career. How you are is not liked by the Western world. And I agree, you know, most of it is generated from Western imperialism. But there are two things that Iran says that if it changed, it would instantly allow for many more people a better image on Iran. One, Iran cannot say down with America or death to America. We change the slogan to down with the empire. And then you'll have allies everywhere in the world.
Well, let's go back to, we were talking about how you came on this path and you decided. You were telling me about some of the reasons why. At this point in time, you just mentioned a little bit about some of the reactions already that you were hearing about from the West, from the States. Tell me possible challenges now that you think you may be facing as you go back home.
Well, I'm sure when I get back, I'll have some questions at customs, or it'll be harder for me to it'll be harder for me to fly on TSA regulated airlines. But you know, it's unfortunate that there's this reverse anti-Semitism, I guess you'd call it. It's there. You know, it never occurred to me to be anti-Muslim. I always accepted Muhammad and Islam, as long as I'd studied the religion, as long as I'd studied the history of this place.
So you never had that prejudice?
Never. Mm-hmm. Never. It didn't make sense to me, you see, because we're all human beings. And I understand human behavior. I mean, my job is a filmmaker. My job is to study humans, to interact with everyone, to talk to everyone. It doesn't occur to me to be prejudiced. I mean, you know, literally, like, the guys I used to, actually, my first introduction to Islam was one of my mentors. As a high school kid, I was working in South Central in the ghettos in L.A. with a program called Unity One, trying to basically teach a program that would help young kids from getting into gang life. And also we worked in prisons. And the guy running the organization was a Muslim. And I just, you know, I always looked at it like, you know, you have a great, tremendous faith. You know, you have love of God. So what if, you know, frankly, I think the big issue with Islam is that they just have certain customs that freak Westerners out. Like, you know, you can't eat pork. Oh, that's so funny. Ha, ha, ha. Well, meanwhile, you know, pigs are how close to us in terms of genetics? I mean, they're almost the same as monkeys. Why would you want to eat a monkey? Why, so what's this, it's the same thing as eating pork, you know?
And something, of course, in the Torah. I mean, it's not like it's foreign for them.
It did exist, but only Orthodox Jews practice it, and you don't find too many of them. So there's certain little things that people mock about Islam. Well, you can have multiple wives, right? Polygamy. Well, what's the reason for it? Muhammad talks about the reason being they're on campaigns, there's wars, there's more women than men in the population. So his idea is, you know, these women have to be cared for rather than being alone, being a single mother or being a miserly woman. He wants the woman to be taken care of. So that's the principle behind it. Now, whether or not you still continue to practice it, you know, that should be a personal choice. The issue of, for example, the veil. You know, as an outsider, I didn't even realize that in Iran, you had to wear the veil, but I didn't realize it wasn't the full veil to the eyes because I'd seen.
Because the word veil is used, everyone thinks it's the
exactly
face.
The hijab is different from the veil, right? And the veil worn by the Saudi women, which is. You know, again, that's a different style of Islam than Iranian Islam. But they're ultimately interpretations of the same texts, right? It's like one country says, in France, they say you can go topless. In America, you can't go topless.
Right.
Do we go around, you know, making a big fuss about it? Maybe we should. But at the end of the day, that's very similar to saying, you know, you should wear a covering over your head. You know, in America, women used to do that. Up through the 50s, they used to cover themselves pretty well. They were decently clothed. They didn't walk around like sluts the way most of them do now.
It doesn't make a difference. You're saying that, but a lot of people you talk to, a lot of American women, they would say it's their right, it's their bodies, it doesn't really make a difference. It's their choice.
Sure, and I agree with them, but it's a revolution that took place in the last 40 years. So the problem is they have no historical knowledge. They don't understand history. You think that because you were born into this culture, it's always going to be this way and it's always been this way? Don't you take the time to actually think, you know, and actually discuss and figure out why are they wearing this hijab? What is it in their tradition? You know, people can be different. Why do we expect everyone to conform? Isn't that like that's a very advertising-based mentality to think that everyone should buy the same things. Let's all buy Nike. Let's all conform and buy the same clothing. Let's all look the same and dress the same.
Right.
What is this conformism that's taken over our culture? We used to have, I mean, frankly, it's funny because I'm being attacked, you know, I'm sure I'll be attacked in the West, but the point is, hey, at least I'm doing something radical again. People used to do this kind of stuff, you know, at least Sean Penn, a few people are out there, Mel Gibson, they're still out there doing some radical things, Charlie Sheen, and, you know, we get shocked, but the point is we still are fascinated by these moments that kind of shake the world that we're used to. But there used to be much more, you know, at least I'm doing it with a principle, there used to be people that would do it. Muhammad Ali did the same thing, and he shook the world.
A lot more diversity, different perspective.
Yeah, I mean, what happened to that? What happened to being a character? What happened to just saying, look, this is the way I think, and, you know, Bob Dylan would do it. He would say, you know, this is what I think, and screw you if you don't get it, you know?
Well, I think it goes back to, I want to ask you that also, to what you had just talked about a little bit ago about basically projecting Islam as being very dark or negative, especially in the West right now.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned, for example, Sharia, and we know that word is used sometimes now in the U.S. We have different states and saying, oh my God, you know, the state, they're thinking about actually going with Islamic Sharia. And it seems that a lot of fear techniques are being used to cause a division of peoples, that
yes.
The people do not come together.
That's right.
What should be done? What is the key now? How do we bring people back together?
Moral courage. Courage of leadership. You know, we don't have many people to look to and say, this is a man of principle. He's someone who's a listener. He's someone who can actually go and have a conversation with a king or a peasant, you know. We don't have that anymore. We've come down to this point of slogans and words. Linguistics are very powerful. Bertrand Russell was an evil guy in many ways. He was a British philosopher who promoted the idea that every generation there should be a black death to keep the world's population in check. And mostly it should be the brown and black and yellow peoples who should die. And he said, you know, there will become a day when we can say snow is black, and that will be true because we will teach them that. Snow is black. Linguistics. once you believe that the word correlates to that notion or that idea, it becomes truth. So it's no longer predicated on that, on the principles of understanding, which all humans share, the principles of wanting to actually live safe lives with laws, with security. You know, that this is like, that's a good principle, but they turn it into a national security state. You know, they turn security into barring all foreigners that we don't like, or, you know, keeping Muslims out of the country, or, you know, claiming that Muslims are the ones who are jeopardizing your security. Meanwhile, there's plenty of people in America that are nuts, that will kill you anyway, or that are starving, that are, you know, in very dire need. Why are we focusing on them? Why aren't we helping our own people? I think that the solution is going to be leaders who say, focus on your country. Focus on cleaning your house. Let's elevate our poor. Let's raise our standard of living. Let's have a future of progress and prosperity. Let's look towards the stars again. You know, let's build. Let's build and create as much as possible. Why are we focused so outward, except the fact that they are trying to mask all the martial law? They're basically masking the martial law that they're doing at home by focusing on the enemy abroad. Oh, now the Iranians want to kill you. The Iranians are going to nuke you. So meanwhile, we can proclaim with the National Defense Authorization Act, the NDAA of 2012, says American citizens can now be detained by the military, our military, indefinitely. No civilian trial. Oh, but don't look here. Let's look abroad. Let's go focus on Iran.
Okay. Well, we're just about out of time, Sean. Just a couple of thoughts. Now that you're going back to the States, tell me reactions that you're expecting from family, from friends.
I think I have a big job ahead of me, and I've chosen it. I have a job of helping people understand, of teaching, and helping to, you know, enlighten my fellow man. Inshallah.
Inshallah. Well, thank you very much. I appreciate you talking to me, and I wish and pray for you all the best.